Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
I keep my head down. I keep my eyes on you. It's a big, wide world with a million shades of modern blue.
That's Roseanne Cash, who is with us this hour. That anthem, Modern Blue, is from her latest album, and it's what we're exploring this hour. Anthems and voices of now, getting out the truth through the power of song. Song, which someone once defined as a single voice telling the truth.
I smell the familiar odor of tear gas, and there are clouds of white smoke some 100 meters from me, where the Shokovichna Street crosses Institutska.
That is a single voice not singing, but the story he tells from the streets of Kiev in Ukraine has been heard by thousands of Rapt followers, listening and watching his online reports this week from the midst of some of the worst violence in Kiev since World War II.
I'm walking along the central street, Khreshchatyk, towards the central square. A couple of blocks down from Maidan, I see black smoke rising into the air, and there are hundreds of people, mostly men, some of them in self-made body armor with baseball bats and iron rods and helmets and all kinds of stuff that they think may protect them in the case of clashes.
He's Andriy Kulikov, one of the voices of public radio, public media being born in the midst of a revolution, broadcasting in English and Ukrainian. The podcasts of Andriy and his colleagues have created a crowdsourced media channel that has spiked its audience to tens of thousands when it's occasionally heard on traditional radio. Their mission is bringing firsthand accounts of the story to the outside world. Andriy Kulikov joins us now from Kiev. Andriy, welcome.
Hi.
Can you describe what's been going on the last 24 hours? You've seen and have had to broadcast some very harrowing reports.
After the immense shock, people started to come back with the thoughts of how to build our life back. Of course, there's a feeling of overwhelming mourning and grief, but still there's a glimmer of hope. People stood in Maidan counting their dead, and they prayed, and they cried, and they were and still are very resolute to stand there until their requirements are fulfilled. And of course, everybody is very much following the events in Verkhovna Rada, Ukraine's parliament, and around it. And they also paid quite an attention to the rather unexpected statement by President Yanukovych, who said that he initiates early presidential elections.
Do you think this is a capitulation, or do you think this is another delaying tactic?
Actually, neither nor, because in my view, early elections for Mr. Yanukovych give quite a chance to claim back his power in a legitimate way, as long as this can be considered legitimate after all the bloodshed that we witnessed or that we lived through. Because it is exactly because of this bloodshed that part of the country thinks that it's not the authorities who are guilty of it, but those who came to protest, those who came to defend their rights. And very many people in some parts of the country and in some social strata are scared of what's been happening, and they may tend to vote for a guy with a strong hand, you know. I think my personal impression is that if the opposition were to prepare for regular elections, in an insistent and methodical way, they would have stood a better chance to win it.
You are a public radio correspondent affiliated with 10 other journalists or so who have begun broadcasting on the Internet, really, as this unrest began. And we spoke actually with someone from Canada who we're pretty convinced is one of your most loyal listeners and viewers, as well as to other Internet broadcasts coming directly from Kiev. Her impression was that the authorities and the protesters are engaged in a level of violence that the cameras and being under the scrutiny of the eyes of the world does not constrain at all. Nobody feels they're going to be held accountable, that this violence is just unbridled. How can there be reconciliation if that is the case, Andriy?
That's the question that I ponder every minute of the last days and even before, because there was a premonition that this was going to happen. But Ukrainians and Ukraine have gone through so many similar happenings in our history that sooner or later I think this can happen. How to do this? One of the things is to try to talk to each other. A very huge problem in Ukraine is that we're sort of narrowing our vision and that we do not talk to each other as much as we should. That's one of the reasons we said this public radio on the Internet, because we see, I and my colleagues see, that many channels and many radio stations tend to adhere to only one point of view and do not offer the range of opinion. So I think that with the help of dissemination of objective information from both sides of the barricades, we can finally overcome this difficulty. This will take a lot of time and a lot of effort, but I'm pretty sure this can be done. And I've been in between the lines. I've been in between, standing just between the lines of protesters and between the lines of police. And I know that even at the last moment, they think before they hit each other. So we have to catch this last moment and help them to understand that it's not in their interests to be enemies.
We're talking with Andriy Kulikov, who's a public radio Ukraine correspondent, host of a major political talk show on one of the major television channels in Ukraine, ICTV. You know, a narrow point of view on radio, Andriy, is not just a problem in Ukraine. It's a problem we have here in the United States. Let's talk a little bit about the opposition. You've mentioned that a vote for Yanukovych, on some level, may be a vote for a return to stability. I'm wondering if the opposition has, and we're asking everyone this, has the opposition gained credibility through this violent period, or have they lost credibility through this violent period?
They gained some and they lost some. They gained credibility in terms of that they showed that they are going to hold their ground no matter what. And quite a lot of people who were sort of mild supporters of the opposition have seen that those guys are ready to risk not only for themselves but also for people who follow them. On the other hand, they lost some credibility, because although they seem to present a united front on many occasions, in some cases you can see contradictions and hesitation on their part, and many people do not like this. Many people would demand or would require one strong leader on the side of the opposition.
On the ground in Kiev, we're speaking with Andriy Kulikov, public radio Ukraine correspondent. This is The Takeaway. Andriy, we're asking also the question about really the context in which you're broadcasting. Tell us a little bit about the growth of these broadcast channels, Internet broadcasts, and live streaming from Kiev? Has it had an impact? Has it changed things? Has it brought the world into the streets of Kiev?
I would like to think that it has done all those things that you mentioned. I think we and other colleagues on the internet and live streaming did have an impact. I cannot measure it now, but, well, I know that, for instance, Romatskaya TV and other internet television operations attract dozens, if not hundreds of thousands of watchers, viewers. Of course, you have to keep in mind that there are difficulties and hindrances, and not everybody sees everything that they show or this kind of stuff. I know that we are listened to. I know that our podcasts are listened to by several thousand people every day, sometimes more, sometimes less. So there is an impact. I strongly believe that not a single word on radio goes into vacuum.
Is there a song, a music, an anthem of this revolution? Radio is always looking for the music in the voices of protest. What have you found?
Well, we found quite a lot, and we actually have an almost everyday item, which is called Musical Voices of Maidan, Maidan being a Ukrainian word for square, the independent square. Mostly young people, but also some mature musicians are writing songs or rewriting lyrics to their songs, which correspond to the feelings that many people are experiencing now, and pretty much every day you can hear a new song in our podcast about this. Of course, when we started to do this, we experienced an influx of letters and MP packages from our listeners and musicians who told us, please play our music on air, please put it on podcast. And that's when one of my colleagues said, now we are a real radio.
So can you give us a lyric, one lyric before we go, and translate it for us, if we might hear the voice in the way in which it's being heard there in Independence Square?
One of the songs that we featured was stand up, don't stand on your knees, something like this.
Давай, давай, ставай, давай, давай. Самого початку, давай.
Andrei Kulikov, a Ukrainian correspondent, host of a major political talk show on ICTV in Ukraine, one of the people who's created the sense of public radio from the middle of the unrest. Andrei, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Song that shouts out in Ukrainian, stand up, don't be on your knees, one of the anthems of the protests in Kiev. Later this hour, her lyrics need no translation, but there's a lot behind Roseanne Cash's new album, The River and the Thread.
I just want to be a better songwriter, you know, and if I keep focused on that, maybe something bigger comes from that. But, you know, I've heard other songwriters say that if you keep refining your skills, you catch better and better songs from the ether.
There's a cross above the baby's bed, a savior in her dream.
Roseanne Cash, later this hour on The Takeaway.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
All of the talk of security problems in Sochi has so far passed as talk, as the Olympic Winter Games have gone on very expensively and successfully, with some real surprises and spectacular performances, along with some grumbling about Russian machine-made snow and yearnings for the unexpectedly absent Bob Costas on NBC. But there's lots more to come in this final weekend. Mary Pilon, sports reporter for our partner, The New York Times, reporting from Sochi, joins us. Welcome, Mary.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So give me a couple of favorite moments before we look forward into this final weekend.
Well, one of them, figure skating is always a big event at the Winter Games, and the Russians have such a proud tradition in the sport, but they had never won a gold medal in women's singles, and that competition was Thursday evening. And there's kind of been two different types of skaters here, those who are Russian and those who aren't, and the crowd just goes crazy for their the athletes here. And there was a surprise Russian winner who, Adelina Sotnikova, who had been overlooked by the Russians as her for participation in the team event. And she took the gold over Yuna Kim of South Korea, who was the defending Olympic champion. And almost immediately, there were a lot of allegations swirling about the judging. I mean, it's a subjective sport, so the judging is going to be controversial anyway. And in a press conference Friday morning, a couple of Russian coaches, you know, defended the outcome, said it was her night. But of course, you know, that has left some critics still questioning kind of the sausage making of the score, whether she deserved the gold medal or not.
I mean, for me personally, the figure skating upstages the raw athletics that really happen in some of the Olympic events right. That don't get covered. I mean, the raw athletics of pursuit speed skating, the cross country. I mean, you have to be in such shape to do cross country. And then, of course, all incredible. The extreme sports that have been showcased in these Olympics. Take us through that a little bit.
Sure. So the extreme sports have been really fascinating because some of them are new. We've never seen them before. And there's been a lot of attention on the injuries. I was talking to one of the team doctors who said that ACL injuries have been really, really huge. Some of my colleagues have been reporting on the injuries for women in these sports compared to men. So as they grow and develop in more countries, I mean, the U.S. tends to do pretty well in these. As they develop, I'm really curious to see what happens with the regulation of them, because remember, when we're on Olympics, we're watching the best people in the world, you know, tackle the half pipe or the slope style. And if they're falling all over the place, my gosh, you know, you wonder what happens to the rest of us who would even dare to try it. So they're new, they're edgy. There's been a big push from the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, to try and keep the games a little more young and fresh. And these kind of sports, they hope will do that. And they're, you know, beautiful on television. But, you know, it's very different when you're talking to a concussed athlete or someone who's, you know, worked their whole lives and then with one blow has become injured. So it's been really interesting to see that pan out up on the mountains.
Yeah, you got to wonder what some sports medicine doctors are thinking as they're looking at these games. All right, what was in your gut when the Canadian women came back and took that gold from the Americans?
You know, I have to say the Canadians, when it comes to winter sports, they are just not messing around. And hockey there is such a religion. I was more taken with the Russian loss, to be honest.
Right.
And the men's hockey. And I'm curious to see how that kind of plays out with what the vibe is going to be like at the upcoming games. But I think, you know, the Canada and U.S., they're stellar teams this year. And in Vancouver with the women's competition, again, it came down to those two. And I think that more broadly, it'd be interesting to see more teams kind of playing at that level, because that kind of competition like we saw between those two was fantastic. And I think that's Olympic hockey, you could argue, is really one of the best winter sports, because you really do feel like you're seeing the best athletes in that sport in the world competing in a way that they don't really get to otherwise. And so that kind of competition, it's fantastic. I just only wish we would see more of it in the women's game.
Well, let's talk then about what's coming up. Men's hockey, as you alluded to, is going to be decided this weekend. What else should we look for?
Correct. So there's men's hockey. Alpine skiing is coming up. Bobsled is coming up. Cross country. The closing ceremonies on Sunday, which, given how expansive the opening ceremonies were, I think there's a lot of anticipation on what the artistry is going to look like. The Olympic Stadium has come under some fire because it's only going to be used twice. It is a massive stadium. Once was opening, once was closing. So I think it's going to be kind of a reminder of a lot of the successes of the games, but also a lot of the excess. I mean, $50 billion. It's the most expensive games of all time. So I'm curious to see what the end note is. There was obviously a lot of anticipation. It seemed like sports was almost on the back burner before people got on the plane here, between logistics, security, the politics of the games here. I think the athletes reclaimed a lot of the spotlight and earned it. Yeah, you know, it was a very unusual Olympics in a lot of ways, but we'll see at closing ceremonies kind of what the mood is like. I think it's a little too soon to tell what the Sochi legacy is going to be.
Finally, remind us, because in many ways in the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, this is the only chance for the mass audience to see the unusual sort of strategy that's involved in team pursuit speed skating and in the cross country, which is such an exhausting slog. I mean, it really competes with the marathon in terms of just raw endurance. Just take us through those two events before we go.
Well, speed skating in particular, one of the things I find fascinating about it is I think there's an element of luck in a lot of Olympic sports, but in speed skating, I mean, it's so profound how it can be your day or not. And we at the Times have been doing a project where we interview fourth place finishers, and I've talked to some of the speed skaters who finished fourth. And when you talk to them, they're so, so close to the podium. You know, it'll be, my ankle moved this way, or there was a gold medal division that was, I believe, to the thousandths of seconds. So I think that one of the things that makes the speed skating so exhilarating to watch is just that it is so close. And to me, if I was an athlete in that sport, having that much luck or the appearance of it would be really hard to swallow. And in cross country, you know, I think it's going to be anybody's game. I'm curious what the conditions are going to be like. That seems like it's inevitable in any winter games. And that's something that a lot of athletes are going to be talking about. And the impression I've gotten from some athletes is they're very rested up. I think it's a little tough when all your buddies are finished at the village and hanging out and your event is towards the end of the Olympic Games. It's also true with the four-man bobsled. So I think people are rested up and ready to go.
Yeah, the cross-country skiers have the most exhausting slog ahead of them while everyone else is sort of relaxing in the village. Mary Pallon, thanks so much.
Great, thank you.
Mary Pallon is sports reporter for our partner, the New York Times, reporting from Sochi.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Movie time on Friday with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, folks.
Happy Friday, John.
So I know that all you really care about are the Oscars, but we did make you go to some movies to review opening this week. 3 Days to Kill. This seems like Jason Bourne meets Dallas Buyers Club, it seems to me. let's hear a clip.
Sweetie, it just so happens I'm in a meeting here with a real live Italian.
His mama has
a great recipe. He wants to give it to you. His name's Guido. Why don't you say hello to my daughter?
Hello, I am Guido.
Kristen, explain the Dallas Buyers Club and Bourne presence kind of smooshed together here.
First of all, I have to explain what was just happening in that scene. Yep. He's torturing somebody with duct tape while he's on the phone with his teenage daughter. This is a guy who is trying to retire from being a CIA assassin, but just has to do one last hit to finish the job before he can retire. Meanwhile, he's trying to be a good father to his estranged teenage daughter. He frequently has his victims and his daughter help each other out.
But he has to get some medicine. That's the key, right? That's the three days thing. That's what it comes down to.
Yes. So that's the one last set of hits he has to do is so that he can get this medicine to stay alive.
Any good, Rafer?
Well, Kevin Costner is actually pretty good in this role. He's kind of making a comeback these days. Yeah, and it's nice to see him playing kind of an aging, infirm CIA agent. He does it well.
What other kind would he play?
Well, he was just in the Jack Ryan movie.
That's right.
You know, the movie itself is pretty bad. It's pretty botched. All this kind of dark humor with him torturing people and the daughter's subplot, it really doesn't work. I think the fact that you've got an Italian named Guido in the film kind of sums up the imagination there.
Kristen, tenderness towards a daughter, what do you think?
I just felt like it was disjointed. No. There were some moments that I actually really enjoyed, but it just felt like a lot of different stories that shouldn't have been together.
All right, the next movie is In Secret. It's a Victorian love story. And Emile Zola is, I think, a great kind of movie script writer in many ways. I'm a big fan of his novels. Here's a clip.
The first model I ever had was this beautiful redhead, natural red, as I quickly discovered, with the only hitch being that this wonderful creature was deaf as a brick. Couldn't call out. If I wanted adjustments, I had to mold her like a sculptor.
Cast?
Oscar Isaac from the Inside Llewyn Davis film. He's fantastic in this. We also have Elizabeth Olsen and Jessica Lange. And it starts off looking kind of just like a Jane Eyre sort of story, but it quickly becomes incredibly sinister, very sexy, and goes all sorts of places.
You just don't even
expect it to go where it's going to go. And it's just one of the best films I've seen in months. Loved it.
Big rave there.
Loved it.
And you went to Pompeii. That's sort of a disaster film thrown back about 1,000 years or so.
Spino, this is madness. We have to get to the harbor and find a boat. The mountain is going to kill us all.
She risked her life for me, Atticus. Risked everything for me.
Then we will go together.
No. You have your freedom, my friend. Now she is mine.
Titanic with a volcano and a lot of Italians with British accents.
That's very good. It's Titanic meets Spartacus. That's exactly what it is. So Kristen went highbrow this week. I went lowbrow. I saw Pompeii.
You like?
I actually liked this quite a bit. It's a lot of fun. It's really well directed by Paul W.S. Anderson, who does the Resident Evil films.
And
I thought it had a really interesting shading to it with the doom and gloom of Pompeii. I thought it gave it a little heft. I liked it.
And on the Movie Date podcast this week?
We're going to be talking about the very peculiar Best Song nominees for the Oscars. It's going to be an interesting conversation.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
you too, John.
How much is that doggy in the window? Songwriters find inspiration in animals when they aren't writing about lost love, and sometimes animals even help a songwriter get through a heartbreak.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl.
I've been through the desert on a horse with no name.
There the eagles cry.
Death for me and my monkey.
Ooh, foxy lady.
Bears, doggies, eagles, and foxes, that's a pretty paltry subset of the animal kingdom, musically speaking. Genetic diversity is really important on planet Earth, we're told, and musician and composer Michael Hirst took this to heart with Songs for Unusual Creatures. It's also a PBS series dedicated to delivering some musical justice to species like the honey badgers, the blue-footed boobies, and the rare big-eyed furry eye-eye.
It's a nocturnal lemur from Madagascar. And it has this one long middle finger, which it uses to tap on trees and pull out grub.
And that must be what it's doing right now. A sense of the instruments you use, because you always use unusual instruments.
Yeah, there are definitely some unusual instruments in there, but more than anything, I was able to get the Kronos Quartet to perform this song, and they are unusual in themselves. But
they love to take on challenges.
They do. And David Harrington, who's the main guy from Kronos Quartet, fell in love with the eye-eye when I mentioned the idea and started researching it himself. So the song starts off with tapping on the actual bodies of the instruments as the eye-eye does on trees to find hollow spots.
I love that. All right. Jesus Christ Lizard.
Its regular name is the common basilisk. The nickname is the Jesus Christ Lizard because it has this amazing ability to run across water without sinking. It spreads its toes wide and gives it more surface tension. So,
oh, careful. We don't want it to fall in the water.
And the smaller, lighter ones can go actually 60 feet across an entire pond.
Toy pianos, I'm hearing here.
You know, and there's no better toy pianist than Margaret Lang Tan, who was John Cage's protege and is a concert toy pianist. She plays with symphonies. And
so How did you find?
She lives two blocks away from me.
Oh, my.
It's Brooklyn.
Perfect. Okay, blobfish. I've already got a visual, but help me out here.
Well, it's blobular, certainly. It's sort of the jello of the sea. It floats on the bottom of the ocean, as lazy as can be. Hardly has a muscle, but doesn't seem to mind. It eats what floats into its mouth, crustaceans and some brine.
Come on, blobfish.
It's actually a tubax on one side. It's two of the lowest instruments I could find, panned hard left and hard right. So it's Paul Cohen playing The Tubax, which is a contra bass saxophone folded upon itself, and then Doug Quint, otherwise known as the Big Gay Ice Cream Man, playing contra bassoon on the other side.
Is there a story behind Big Gay Ice Cream Man you want to share with us?
He's more famous as the owner of Big Gay Ice Cream, which is taking over the world. But he's also this amazing contra bassoon player.
It's nice to have something to fall back on.
Exactly.
Glass Frog, all right? Let's go out on a magic note here. Glass Frog.
Well, I had to – okay, so the animal is this frog found in South America that has translucent skin, and you can see all of its organs, including its beating heart. I had to use the glass harmonica, which is an instrument invented by Benjamin Franklin, and you play it sort of like wine glasses on a spindle. And so this is Cecilia Brower playing Benjamin Franklin's glass harmonica.
Now, that sounds fabulous, but this isn't one of those poisonous frogs, is it?
No. The glass frogs are not poisonous, but they are very reclusive and hard to find. They live up in the trees in the rainforest, so they stay fairly clear of humans.
Well, we can get access to them through what you've done here. Michael Hurst is creator, host, and composer for the PBS digital series Songs for Unusual Creatures. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Seeking the inspiration for truly great songwriting beyond Grammys, pop hits, and genre classics has been a lifelong journey for artist Roseanne Cash. She has certainly made it by all those traditional measures of success. And her new album, The River and the Thread, is full of titles and lyrics that make you stop and think, like the track, A Feather Is Not a Bird.
I'm going down to Florence, gonna wear a pretty dress.
I wrote the chorus before we wrote the rest of the song.
The feather's not a bird, the rain is not the sea, the stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
It's about the part not being the whole, but still it's all connected to you and through you, past and future.
It's never any highway when you're looking for the past.
Roseanne Cash stopped by our studios and explained how this album is a poignant collision of the past, present, and her hope for the future.
It was multi-layered. There were several journeys, some, you know, deeply unconscious and some geographical. John and I, my husband and I, we wrote all of these songs together. And we started taking a lot of trips down south. There were, it was a bit of a perfect storm of reasons to go down south. One was the restoration of my dad's boyhood home through Arkansas State University. At the same time, I made a really good friend in Alabama, and I was going down, and she was teaching me to sew. And she said this incredible thing when she was teaching me to sew. She said, "You have to learn to love the thread." And she wasn't speaking metaphorically, but I heard it that way. And every roots musician owes something to the Delta. So just to see these places that were mythic, you know, Robert Johnson's grave and the Tallahatchie Bridge and Money, Mississippi, where Emmett Till was killed and the civil rights movement was sparked. All of these places are imbued with such power. So a lot of songs came out of this.
50,000 Watt.
But there's a light on Sunday, the new old design. The sound of the whistle crawls the radio wires. Love in your future, I'll wait for you there. With 50,000 watts of a car.
That says to me, you know, Sunday morning, you know, megachurch, radio broadcast. How does that speak to you? That song brought it all back to me because I used to love to tune in the stations that you could get, you know, where I lived up in Syracuse, New York. And usually the stations that came in the best were those old-time religion stations.
I was thinking about music itself being a common prayer. And that for rural people, farmers, who the salvation was the radio on the weekend, you know, and those stations that broadcast over 50,000 watts and kind of blanketed the country from Mexico to Canada, there's a sense of community in listening to that.
So many different styles on this album. And since you raised the issue of race and music, is Money Road about Emmett Till?
It's about Emmett Till and Robert Johnson.
A lonesome boy in a foreign land, out on Money Road, and a voice we'll never understand, out on Money Road.
One lies in the Zion Yard.
One lies in the Zion Yard.
Which is Robert Johnson.
One sleeps on the river bar.
Which is Emmett Till.
One got very far out on Money Road.
And unbelievably, those spots are within walking distance. I mean, the Delta is what William Faulkner to Howlin' Wolf to Charlie Patton, you know, to Emmett Till, that the civil rights movement, everything that came out of the South. Like, why? Why? This cradle of who we are as Americans, you can find most of it there.
You know, you use in one of the titles here, A World of Strange Design.
Mm.
You mentioned design, strange designs, odd patterns that you notice in a couple of lyrics. It's an odd pairing, it seems to me, but I get the impression of you as a young girl just sort of looking out the window as the world rushes by trying to
make sense
of some of these patterns.
Yeah. That's interesting, too, because when I wrote my memoir, I didn't write it as a strict chronology. I wrote it as patterns. I mean, that's just my makeup. I think it's the way I see the world, like you just said. Trying to see themes that repeat in time, like as time travel, how do these themes repeat? What are the patterns? It interests me a lot.
So many different styles of music in here. It seems to me that your dad, who was such a lover of different styles of music, I would think he would listen to this album and be so proud of the places you have been able to go musically.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope my parents are proud. I think about that, you know, when you lose your parents and you go on with your life and you do something that's important to you, you think, well, I wish they could see this. I think they would like this. My dad, I think The Sunken Lands particularly, which is really the only song on the record that refers directly to the Cash family. And not even really particularly my dad, but my grandmother, his mother, Carrie Cash. I think that would resonate for him, definitely.
Is part of the mission of this album to move forward, to step forward from really a lot of grieving that you've been doing, and not just because of the loss of your mom and dad, but also the struggles that you've had personally?
Yeah. Mission is a big word, John. I don't know. I that sounds grand to me. I just want to be a better songwriter, you know, and if I keep focused on that, maybe something bigger comes from that. But also for John and I, somebody said this record was the sound of a marriage. And that startled me at first, and then I thought, it really is. We played to each other's strengths utterly on this record. And in that way, the feather becomes the bird, you know? And I think, yes, it is redemptive. Connecting to those parts of your past that you thought were gone or insignificant, that's redemptive. Working with my husband, it's all good.
It's all good. How many artists can say that? Roseanne Cash, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Roseanne Cash's new album out now is called The River and the Thread. For those of you in New York, she'll be playing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art this Saturday, February 22nd, as part of their exhibition, Early American Guitars, the Instruments of C.F. Martin.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We have given you a view from the streets of Kiev, where the violence of earlier this week has given way to a guarded hope for the political compromise. Will it hold? Early elections, will they be early enough? The European Union has said it is moving forward with sanctions against those in Ukraine responsible for the violence, including travel bans and the freezing of assets. A more global view now of the situation in Ukraine with Serhiy Plukhy, professor of history and director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. His new book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, is out in May. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
What do you make of the last 24 hours, the idea of early elections, the idea that there may be enough of a concession from Yanukovych to actually calm things down?
All of this is, of course, very positive news. The fact that they stopped shooting people on the streets of Kiev, this is positive in its own right. Plus, we have a resolution of the parliament that prohibits use of military force in Kiev and in other places in Ukraine. There are also signs that President Yanukovych is prepared to have early elections later this year. The big question is that none of that is finalized at that point, and it is not clear whether people on the streets of Kiev will take the deal that was negotiated by the leaders of the opposition, president, and intermediaries coming from European Union and Russia.
One thing we've been told is that Yanukovych appears to have chosen precisely the moment that might favor him politically, because so many Ukrainians are weary of this violence and will vote for him as a vote for a return to some kind of stability. What do you make of that?
What he is prepared to do is to have elections in December of this year. And we are now only in February. So many people are suspicious that basically he is going to use whatever time will be left before the elections to solidify his power. So again, given how things develop now, with what speed, this additional 10 months, it's a long, long period in political terms.
And Professor, we expect to be hearing really over the course of the weekend reports of what the protesters and the opposition's reaction is to all of this. How difficult is that going to be to decipher, in the sense that there are so many different voices speaking for the protesters, for the opposition? How do we decipher all this?
What we hear now from the streets of Kiev is that people who were involved in protests and then were shot at, and close to 100 people died, they want the resignation of the president now. So I think it will be a hard sell for them to say that, okay, you'll have to wait for another 10 months and go to the elections. So we have still at least a few difficult days ahead, but maybe weeks and months.
Well, that leads to the question that we've really been asking all week, and we've gotten very different answers. But it seems like there's a real challenge for Ukraine to get past this disillusionment with the government regarding corruption, and maybe even more difficult for the people of Ukraine to get past the reconciliation that's going to be required to deal with all of this violence between the government and the protesters. Is the government strong enough to actually withstand that level of redemption and reconciliation that's going to be required here?
When we talk about reconciliation, normally what we have in mind, the conflict of one part of the country with another, one social group with another. What we witness on the streets of Kyiv today is the government in conflict with its own people. So it is not like there is self-mobilization on the two sides, and then what will be needed a reconciliation. So the situation is more complex, but is also simpler in a certain way. So the government has to be accountable to its own people. So new elections, and as soon as possible, I believe can be the solution. So not in December, but again, within maybe next to 3 months.
Emotionally, how have you responded to the images coming out of Kiev? And as director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard, you know, there are pages of history being written and rewritten now in Ukraine that I suspect touch you very deeply.
Absolutely. I'm watching it that I'm following that with disbelief. No one predicted that, including people here at our institute. Again, Ukraine for the last 20 plus years had a very peaceful record in terms of resolution its crises. There would be early elections. The presidents would pass peacefully power from one to another. So it came as a complete surprise and shock. And on the top of that, the number of people that were killed, especially yesterday, one of them was a young professor of history in the Ukrainian Catholic University, the university with which we and our institute have really close links. So it's heartbreaking to see what is going on. And again, I couldn't imagine anything like that happening.
You know, you looked around the world in 2010 and you saw all of this democratic unrest and calls for democracy in the Middle East, and it seemed very, very heroic and positive. It certainly didn't turn out that way in places like Egypt and Tunisia. Looking around today in Kiev and in Venezuela and Thailand, are these all one-offs? This is a much darker moment, it seems, for the world than the heroism we were speaking of back in 2010. What are your thoughts?
On the one hand, all of these events have one thing in common, and that thing in common is that the political process doesn't work or didn't work in the countries that were affected by violent protests. So people had to go to the streets to get their voice heard. So on the other hand, there are, of course, differences between what is happening today in Ukraine and what is happening in Venezuela, for example, where it's shortages and lack of freedom of speech that forced people to go on the streets. In Ukraine, again, it was a relatively prosperous period of time. The freedom of speech was under threat, but again, it was a corruption that was a major issue. So from that point of view, maybe there is a little bit more in common between today's Ukraine and Thailand than between Ukraine and Venezuela.
Serhii Plukhy is professor of history and director of the Ukrainian Institute at Harvard. His new book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, is out in May. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've added your thoughts and voices to the anthems coming out of the turmoil in Ukraine. Larry in Brooklyn writes, I didn't know my family was Lithuanian until it became independent after the fall of the USSR. We were called Poles or Russians and almost completely killed off by the Nazis during World War II. So I know that the Ukrainians just want to be autonomous. What's your connection to the unrest in Kiev? Human, historical, ethnic? You can tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And you can get an early jump on all our conversations by signing up to get one text a day. We ask you a question that's featured on the next day's show. You're a part of the conversation. I'm John Hockenberry. Find out how to do that at thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.